You're listening to 9 Plus, a research podcast from SETU Ireland. How's it going? And welcome along to another episode of the 9 Plus podcast, in which we discuss various topics being researched at the Southeast Technological University of Ireland. My name is Rob O'Connor. And this one is particularly relevant and timely. We're discussing mis and disinformation with John Balfe of SETU and Steph Hanlon of Carlow College. We had a great chat about the difference between mis and disinformation, learning about the broad topic of malinformation, leading up to identifying some of the key findings from their research about the causes and the environment that allows malinformation to spread, and the manipulation that's often involved. As academics, or just even as active citizens, it's up to us to be vigilant and call out malinformation as we see it. Equally, being respectful to some of the victims of this kind of stuff, whether it's people who are demonised by untruths or people who are influenced by viewing poor quality information in their social media feeds. Steph and John reference a number of sources throughout the conversation, which are included in the show notes, so you can follow up your reading if you like. And there's even a link to the Homer Simpson Arse Couch Groove. And that reference will make sense once you've heard the podcast. So now let's discuss the murky world of mis, dis and malinformation.
Thank you very much for having me on. My name is Steph Hanlon. I'm a lecturer and program director in social, political and community studies in Carlow College, and my research focus is on migration and citizenship.
Hi Rob, my name is John Balfe and I'm a lecturer on the Carlow campus in SETU, and I teach in the Department of Humanities and I teach on programmes of professional social care, early childhood education. I also teach and then a master's in child, youth and family and some specialised specific award purposes like restorative practice, gender-based violence certificates. And my research interest is in around working with asylum seekers and refugees, but also I'm currently doing my doctorate around the professionalisation of social programmes like social care, social work type professions.
So we're going to talk about the broad topic of misinformation and disinformation, and a lot of your research around this, particularly around migrants, around some items that have been in the news lately, etc. I'm very interested to hear the kind of the scholarly position that's evidence-based as opposed to just tell you what I heard online, or this fella said this to me, or I read this on such and such a place. But we might start by just defining those terms, because sometimes I hear them used as if they're interchangeable, but they're actually not. So Steph, you're nodding. So I wonder, could you just explain what is misinformation and what is disinformation, just so that we know the difference between the two?
Yeah, I know, you're dead right. Misinformation and disinformation are often conflated. So essentially, the difference is intent and purpose. So misinformation is when false information is shared but no harm is meant. And then disinformation is when false information is shared and there is a specific intent to harm. Mm. And, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the different categories, you also have malinformation as well, which is the very specific strategy and purpose to inject disinformation strategies.
Okay. So, John, you're nodding with that. Is there anything you want to add to that kind of definition of misinformation, disinformation, malinformation before we kind of get into the weeds on it?
Yeah, no, Steph is absolutely right. It's around the intention. Both can be destructive in their forms, and you know, both play a role in terms of informing public opinion, and with maybe possibly different outcomes, and I suppose in the context of working with the whole issue of asylum seeker refugee, this is a real issue because we live in a digital age now, and a lot of the information generated about that anti-asylum and that anti-immigrant sentiment generates in that digital platform. And I suppose that's the difference between now and so many years ago, I suppose, where we didn't have that as much of a as an issue. Mm. Whereas now it's very much to the forefront, where people are getting a lot of their information not from mainstream outlets or credible journalism. It's more from those type of platforms where people enter into a silo of information. And it, you know, the whole thing that's connected with misinformation, disinformation that we might get to talk about as well is the issues around confirmation bias and terms like this that, you know, are kind of bandied around, but people actually, we all do it, you know, as academics, we tend to do it as well. We have to be very conscious of it. We have to be reflective of it in our own research and making sure that we have all sides of an argument and we research thoroughly a topic or an issue. But what tends to happen a lot of the time, you know, from a kind of a public opinion point of view, that people enter into these kind of what's called echo chambers or these silos of information, and they go with a set of beliefs that they may already hold. And that's reinforced or reaffirmed for them by the information that they search for.
So say for I think I know what you're talking about, but just to, I'm going to repeat something back to you with an example that you might just confirm or improve for me. So I'm going to use Brexit as an example, and I know you're all delighted that I was going to talk about Brexit.
Yeah.
But let's say
curveball.
Okay, so let's say I'm somebody of a certain age in a certain part of England, right? And I'm on Facebook and I've already liked a video that talked about, you know, too many immigrants or something like that or whatever it might be. Or I've been looking at certain articles from certain newspapers or whatever. And then on my feed on, I'm just saying Facebook, but it could be really any of the social platforms. But I know Facebook was heavily implicated in things with Brexit. It starts, the algorithm starts serving me up more posts along the same lines as opposed to articles or pieces that might say, actually, this is the case elsewhere, or there's another side to this story. Is that what you're kind of referring to?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and it is certainly to kind of build on that point, what happens with the algorithmic formula, you know, that social media companies, really, they're interested in generating content, you know, and clout. And I suppose kind of like I'm thinking of a quote I was reading recently from a book from Naomi Klein and on her whole issue around doppelganger. And she was talking about, you know, influence sways, you know, you kind of influence can sway and come and go. But certainly clout squats, you know, it holds space. And the more things that people like and the more people things kind of when you follow certain things and the more content is generated, the more dopamine level is released that your post is liked or that you're following or reposting certain piece of information. And I think that it, like the Brexit example is a prime example of how that happened when you had actually public representatives, the likes of Boris Johnson and the Tory party a lot, generating disinformation in this instance, you know, a lot about the NHS and the cost it was going to, you know, it was actually found to be untrue, a lot of it, when it was under scrutiny.
But they also knew it was untrue, isn't that in that case?
That was, well, that certainly, I think a lot of the evidence would suggest that a lot of the Tory representatives or even, you know, Nigel Farage, but if you had Nigel Farage here in the studio with us, you know, he would be saying something very different.
That's a very academic answer. Steph, you're kind of nodding. You're agreeing with that. You think that's fair enough?
Yeah, well, if you bring it to, like you mentioned, Brexit.
Okay, I only use that as an example because I thought it's something that we have a little bit of historical distance from.
That's exactly what I want to say. Okay. So now we see misinformation and disinformation being talked about. However, as observers in Ireland, like we have been looking at disinformation and misinformation, you know, from a global politics stage. So with Brexit, with the presidential election, in 2017, the Oxford Commons Dictionary named fake news as the word of the year.
Right. Okay. And 2017, is that far back? Wow.
But then think about the 2016 election, okay? So between Brexit and between the American presidential election, the use of the term fake news rose by 365%. Yeah. So, I mean, this is another kind of part of this, you know, this kind of phenomenon of mis and disinformation. So we talk about the same time at the moment we are suffering under those kind of attacks. But really importantly as well, in relation to like misinformation, disinformation, fake news it forms two purposes. So first of all, it's a very contested term. So it can be used to describe something with malintent, you know, it's disinformation. But at the same time, it can be used as a rhetorical strategy. So what we saw was Donald Trump very famously saying, well, that's fake news. That's fake news. Mm. So one of the biggest proponents of it actually was using it to discredit his opponents or his critiques. So, you know, when it comes to, like John mentioned about the importance of being able to identify and be aware of what constitutes misinformation, and then as a result, be more aware of when people are trying to employ disinformation strategies and sow uncertainty, you know, that's absolutely essential, because it is employed very strategically in a number of different political contexts.
Mm. And I think that's a little bit about, you know, the malinformation piece as well, and particularly terms like fake news and what Trump did around these kind of terms. What elements of, you know, I suppose more conservative, right wing, far right elements have done is that they've used, you know, language that had been around for some time. You know, fake news was actually a very good way of explaining when things were being presented to the public that weren't true, you know, and it was a term used in left academic circles for a long time. And now, you know, because that language has been weaponized in some way, or what the right or the far right have done very well is that they've managed to mirror a lot of what, you know, were credible pieces of language or terms or concepts used, and turned them into their own interpretation. You know, so when you have Steve Bannon in the States talking about, you know, that the you know, the left are saying that the election was won fair and square, he's using terms like the election was stolen, you know, he's kind of mirroring a lot of what the language is on in terms of reality. And what we're having now is not a debate about between, say, who won the election. It's a debate now about who's living in reality. Okay. You know, and what is reality anymore? And, you know, we're seeing kind of these emerging of terms and language that is rendering a lot of people actually speechless. You know, those kind of terms are being stolen from us in some ways, because now they all mean something completely different in terms of kind of how they've been politicised. And even just when you come back to Brexit, there's some really interesting pieces of research done by research of cognitive social scientists, Daniel Jolly and Karen Douglas. They talk about this cognitive satisfaction around conspiracy theories, that, you know, there is an element of satisfaction cognitively when you have complex issues like immigration, and you have issues like people saying they're coming over here taking our dentist appointments, our doctors, our housing, they're coming raping our women and children, the crime rates are going up. You have very complex terms that, by the way, none of that is actually evidenced to be true, and certainly a lot of it, there's very complex issues around all of those, not necessarily to do with migration. So when you have those kind of tricky social concepts being bandied around, it's very easy for people to look for a simple, quick fix. And there's also an emotional identity aspect to this as well. And Jolly and Douglas talk about this, that, you know, when people feel disenfranchised, when communities feel left out, when structural inequality takes over, and these are kind of some of the real issues that are happening in our communities, then it's very easy to kind of blame the other. And the othering process that goes on then is very much kind of manifests in, you know, this kind of idea that someone else is to blame for my my misfortune or my lack of opportunity, my inability to get a job or to strive for a living. And these are kind of real issues people are facing. And I suppose it's very easy to tarnish, you know, the protests and kind of and call people far right, and people have been critical of that, to say, oh, you're calling all protesters far right, and it's not as simple as that. Like, you have people from very disenfranchised communities being weaponized by very a small amount of people, usually from British or American origin, coming in, financing, and also feeding a narrative to people. And it's not to say there's people that they don't understand, and some people reject these ideas. So we have to be very careful about tarnishing and blaming everybody to say, and it's very easy to dismiss people as being far right and then to shut the conversation down. Like as Milton said in Paradise Lost, I think there was a quote he said, you know, it's better to be, when he was talking about Lucifer, I think he was saying it's better to be a servant in hell than rain in hell, servant in heaven, you know. Yeah. So when we shut people down, they don't just go away, they go somewhere else. Yeah. And that's where this is being capitalised. Sorry, Stefan.
No, I think John's really, you know, really made some good points about the importance of social sciences and humanities in dealing with this. You know, because, you know, you cited research that is touching on these issues. And I mean, we both come from a social science perspective as well and are very interdisciplinary. So, you know, for us, we're looking at social patterns. These are not new phenomena. These are phenomena that are studied and are cornerstones of social sciences. So poverty, inequality, structural violence, issues around services, housing, you know, age demographics, migration patterns, like, these are all very much cornerstones of the study of society. However, what we're seeing now are the changing patterns and factors. So, for example, as well as the points that John mentioned in relation to, you know, algorithms, we also are living in a society where it is an attention economy. You know, we're talking here hugely about the role of profit.
Yeah.
So if we're talking about misinformation, disinformation, there's much more than just the human side of it. There's also the responsibility and the burden of responsibility on social media companies who are making huge profits from this because, well, clicks and likes and more time spent listening or watching videos is more money. And the simple point is outrageous, shocking, you know, eye-catching pieces, they're the ones that are going to garner the likes. They're the ones who are going to hold on to the attention for that little bit longer with the detrimental impacts. But, you know, based on research that I've conducted as well, if you look at the state of, you know, for example, Telegram, that narrative of unvetted Irish males. So that over the period of the last year,
unvetted military age males.
Yes, exactly. The construction of unvetted military age men has become rampant in common discourse in the last year alone.
Yeah.
However, an analysis of Telegram channels, okay, so all of the far-right
Telegram
channels. So
I'm just going to pull you back for 1 second. I don't want to interrupt you, but just you might Telegram is a messaging service similar to WhatsApp, but it's encrypted, it's global, and it's one that is used a lot by certain groups who wish to remain anonymous, shall we say. Is that right? Yes.
Okay. No, that's exactly it. Like, for example, from 2021, there were no users on Telegram. And this is where, as John mentioned, we see that importing from the US and from the UK, because Telegram was predominantly used by far-right extremist groups like the Proud Boys and white supremacists in America to organise and to mobilise and to spread disinformation. In Ireland, there was no groups using Telegram until COVID-19 hit. There were clampdowns and people were trying to organise, not on Facebook or places where they could openly be seen to be in breach of public health guidelines. Within that, I mean, you're talking about, you know, far-right groups manifesting and multiplying, but a huge amount of them not being Irish. So actual actors being British. But if you look at origins of far-right accounts, the majority of posts and of shares that were using that phrase and using that term that were then recycled, repopulated, brought onto more more commonly used social media, so YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, X, they all came from an account with 1,400 followers.
Right.
Okay. And that's the Irish context.
Yeah.
So to give an idea, you know, of the minority of people who are receiving huge amplification, I mean, that really needs to be highlighted because, you know, these narratives, you know, this framing of people, it's not just really, really dangerous in how it manifests. And we see physical attacks on people, intimidation, you know, arson attacks, protests, you know, like that is a manifestation directly of these incitement to hatred and incitement to violence, but by a very, very small number of actors in Ireland.
Mm. John, you quoted Milton. I'm going to quote somebody a bit more contemporary, although still a dinosaur by modern. But Johnny Rotten was anger is an energy. And thinking about, I've heard many times on social media, if you get somebody angry, you get them engaged, as opposed to if somebody's happy and fluffy, they just move on by.
Mm.
So that's a way of kind of feeding the beast, feeding the algorithm, keeping your eyeballs on the system. And therefore, that's a feedback loop, because yeah. then we'll serve you up more content like this, which will keep you more engaged and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it's easier to go back to the reductive thing. It's easier to blame them people over there, whoever they are, and they're slightly different to you in some superficial way probably, than blame or than look at a complex, potentially abstract economic mm-hmm. system that might be causing issues with housing or healthcare or whatever the issue might be. Is that fair enough?
That is absolutely massive. And I really like how you mentioned anger, okay? Because anger is important. I teach social policy, I teach politics to students, and the most important thing that we do in class first and foremost is get people angry.
Oh, really?
Yeah, definitely. Oh, my students come out and they're so pissed. They're like, what the hell's wrong with the world? And I'm like, I've done my job, yeah. okay? We're doing well, this is great.
It's a good lecture.
Yeah, exactly.
The come out fight club.
Exactly, that's what I want, you know. Don't tell my boss, but yeah.
Yeah.
So like essentially what it is, you know, you're working to building people's consciousness,
yeah.
you know, and raising critical awareness, but also providing evidence and providing information to people to back up those arguments. In the meantime, anger is important. What the two components of any successful social movement are outrage and hope, according to Manuel Castells, who I completely agree with. So they're networks of outrage. So first of all, people need to be outraged and outraged enough to actually take action and act.
Yes.
Because there is a certain level of complacency when things are seemingly normal. If you want to take the wind out of the sails of any social movement, is to give something small. If the government gives something small or if an institution gives something small, it immediately takes the wind because it removes the outrage.
Yes.
In the case of the very, very righteous and very understandable anger, when it comes to periods of crises right now, we speak the language of crises. So we have a housing crisis, a healthcare crisis, an environmental disaster on our hands. We have a cost of living crisis. And then we had a COVID-19, you know, global pandemic. It's a pretty crazy time to be alive.
Mm.
In this time, what you have is a lot of people who have been changed by the pandemic, as in public fate in institutions, in academia, in science, in government has, you know, faltered. So with that, when you're talking about anger and the question of directing it in certain places, you have a lot of very angry people whose trust is completely and utterly undermined in the institutions that previously would have had weight in basically providing evidence and, you know, providing information to people, to an informed public.
Mm.
So in the case of this, you know, what you often have as well is like attempts to attack NGOs and the NGO industry and all of this, because once again, you're undermining, you know, particularly progressive, you know, groups and organizations who have been fighting for civil liberties.
Mm.
And let's not forget, particularly, you know, the people who have been on the receiving end of this minority of actors who are very, very well known to people who are on the front lines of repeal, on the front lines of marriage equality, and the front lines of the Gender Recognition Act.
Mm.
We know those people. We've met those people and we've had to deal with them and their threats and their intimidation. But they are the same people who are coming out now saying, we're protecting our women, we're protecting our children. Oh, what about these violent, nameless, faceless strangers in our midst?
Can I play devil's advocate for just a moment? Please, I'm very much playing devil's advocate, OK? So I'm not necessarily saying that I believe this, OK? But I'm trying to frame this as somebody, well, you would say that. Because you're liberal academics and you have privileged positions and you don't know what it's like in the real world. You're saying everyone on the right is a bad actor. And bear in mind, I'm not saying you've said this, okay? But this is I'm forming a thought on the fly. The way you've described this so far, it seems like a lot of the issues are if we have a left-right political division, which is reductive, and I know it's reductive, where, say, on the left is progressiveness, on the right is conservatism, that you're saying a lot of the issues are on the right. Is that true? Is that fair? Or is that being simplistic as well?
I might just respond in terms of rather than being defensive about it, I think it's
I hope you don't know. I was only asking
absolutely. I think it's a valid question, and it's an important question, because for those of us on the left as well, we really have to examine what we have done, because there has been a certain amount of arrogance, I think, and a certain amount has been, I suppose acceptance that, oh, this is, you know, how would people go to the right and how would they jump there? What we're seeing at the minute is like a lot of diagonalism of people jumping from left to right wing politics and all over the place. And like the political ground at the moment is quite volatile, but quite interesting in terms of the amount of political parties and the parties that are rising. And I think what we've done is sometimes we've shut down people in a way that, you know, you can't be talking about these kind of things, or almost, kind of alienating people. And people just don't go away with that. You know, they're fostered somewhere else. And I think what's tended to happen is that they have found an audience in other people who have been much more accepting of that because they've jumped in around, particularly to do with COVID-19. Yeah. We've conflation of issues of, kind of conspiracy theories around health and vaccination, and people who may have been liberal minded about these kind of issues before, you know, there has been a conflict there about vaccination and whether we've been poisoned, the theories about vaccination of having certain particles that interfere with your brain and your heart, and none of which is, by the way, true. But at the same time, you know, you have maybe people who have a very good immune system and healthy and kind of health gurus. And I suppose you have the rise of the influencer as well, and kind of these kind of people who have come in, like Jenny McCarthy, for example, you know, jumping in and saying, you know, I protect me and my healthy baby and I don't need to be vaccinated.
Sorry. She's an American who had she was an anti-vax American, but that was an autism thing, if I'm right.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. So she, you know, her whole thing that, you know, my child has been destroyed by the vaccination, and very much kind of jumping into the Andrew Wakefield paper that was discredited in The Lancet in 1997. I think she was in a relationship with Wakefield and very much kind of we're being now given our information by not necessarily evidence-based influencers. You know, they've jumped in on things. And I think as the other side of it is from the left, to come back to your question, is we've tended to let that slip a bit. And I don't think we have been as proactive as we should have been in terms of engaging with people and actually going out and maybe having a bit more of a critical analysis about these issues or entering into debates. Now, in saying that, I think it's been extremely difficult to do that. For example, with protests that were happening in Carlow around people being put in, asylum seekers, and rumours being spread that 50 military age unvetted men were coming into the building. It was quite a minority, but a strong protest. You know, when I engaged with people around that protest, it was very difficult to engage in a civil debate. And in principles of democracy, of agreeing to disagree, just didn't exist. And a lot of the times I was just shouted down and, you know, called names and told Roger O'Gorman was a paedophile and, you know, that kind of just very hard to engage with that kind of logic. But at the other side is, I think there are ways that we can civilly engage with groups through community organisations, particularly young people. And there's a movement in Carlow happening around, Carlow for All, where we're talking to community groups about how do we engage with this kind of sentiment of hatred to people of colour, race, you know, of asylum seeker, refugee, anyone who's different. And I think that's a possible way of engaging with that from a grassroots level. And I'd like to see more of that, I think. I think the point there is valid. I'm not sure, Steph, you probably have something to say about that as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, so First of all, just in relation to academics being liberal, I will say hashtag not all academics.
Because,
there's quite a few academics out there and quite well-known public figures who went into politics who were very, very much on the other end of the spectrum and who were given a lot of weight because of their academic profile. The other thing is I'm a member of the Irish Precarity Network. The Irish Precarity Network. A very proud, loud member, and basically, you know, over 70% of academia are people on part-time, temporary, fixed-purpose contracts. Okay, so people teaching 2-3 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, students, when they do know about this, because, you know, we teach about employment and, you know, we're living in a world of insecurity when it comes to employment. And to say, like, just to, I suppose, the nature of jobs, even compared to 10, 15 years ago, like, you know, the farmer was, you know, like 20 years ago, the farmer was the main person in the village. You know, the priest was really high up, the school teacher. Things have massively changed now. And it's the same with academia. But that's why it's really important, you know, I think for academics to be speaking out and not perpetuating those stereotypes that there's a lot of people in academia who are very, very much just as affected by the issues as everyone else. But that's also why it's really important for me when I'm asking, you know, academics and researchers to move beyond the classroom and move beyond the office and the journal articles. Because, you know, as John mentioned, dialogue and debate is absolutely essential. And I was so happy to hear, I had some feedback from a student a couple of weeks before term ended. And she had said to me how really important social policy was, because her family were the families that were out. Three of her families in her wider family were out protesting in Carlow. They were at the protests.
Right.
And she stopped them protesting on the third night by sitting them down and being like, you need to understand, you know, I'm studying social policy. This is what I'm learning. I'm providing them with a recently written essay, you know.
But she probably didn't present it as an essay. She presented it as a conversation.
Exactly.
And like, so I don't mean to interrupt you, but you're really sparking something in my head here now, which is, so my own research area at the moment is, I'm kind of looking at broadly science communication, but I don't just consider it just science. I would consider it research, scholarly communication. And there's a clear delineation in the literature from kind of basically pre-2020 and post-2020. You've got this big mark there, which is COVID. And there's so much that's wrapped up around all of these influencers, people who are kind of entertainers, but they're emotive. And they provoke that response like we were talking about earlier. Whereas the academic or the expert will always kind of hedge their bets or present things in a sober, measured way that is kind of boring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it's kind of, if somebody, it's like somebody reading you a dictionary, it's full of wonderful information. But if somebody is beside you going whang bang, it's hard to compete with that.
Yeah, you definitely. Know? Oh, I've definitely contemplated bringing sparklers into the class to try and liven things up a little bit. Like,
I already have.
There you go. I just use my wonderful sense of humour. Do you know what I mean? And then I wave over, and you know, you have an exam at the end of the year, so just remember that when you're laughing. Do you know what I mean? It's grades for laughs. Like,
so talking about getting out of the classroom, and I know we're talking in a podcast here, which is obviously maybe part of that mix, but what way do you think this is? So say we as academics, okay, are experts in the broader sense of the term. How do we help? What can we do? What can we contribute in a positive way?
So we have a really, last year for March is Anti-Racism Month. So, you know, amidst an increasingly, you know, fraught climate around immigration and migration, a wonderful colleague of mine, Joseph Maguni, who's a community development worker and longtime youth worker, Joseph and students from across each of the programmes in Carlow College, particularly the African Caribbean Society, our affected communities, LGBT communities, held a one-day conference in the George Bernard Shaw Theatre. No, that's not true. The visual. Sorry.
You're right. No, it's called the George Bernard Shaw.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. In the George Bernard Shaw on Together Against Racism. and it was attended by about four primary schools, and there was about 500 people throughout the day, public elected officials as well, public representatives coming and going. So the real people in the community that you want to get these messages across to. And we had it from, you know, people who were directly impacted by this on like a number of different issues, everything from disability, intergenerational trauma, LGBTQ issues, whitewashing, you know, racism, you know, anti-traveller discrimination as well. So, you know, that is a really good example of, you know, like the college is also a community. It is the heart of a community. And it's really about getting that across, because we're in a really privileged position to reach out and communicate to people. And it's like you're saying, it's kind of using that weight of the expert, which I'd be very, very afraid to.
I know, you've made air quotes and I've done the same as well. But yes,
That's exactly it. Yeah, like, because, you know, if it can help sway people and if it can bring people around, 100%. So also I was asked in by the Students' Union to do something around voter literacy, you know, voter patterns from a political science background. How do you vote? How do you tell, you know, truth from fiction, AI, digital manipulated photos, videos, X, Y, and Z. And that was just a 1 day workshop as part of, they had this politics week, which was great. Another one is talk to public representatives around sharing misinformation or repeating misinformation. So there is a plethora of things depending on your discipline. So, like, you know, so many amazing academics in so many amazing areas that could just do so much for the community.
I think it's a really important question, and it's fundamental to what we do. And a little bit of what you're talking about is pedagogy beyond the curriculum. You know, it's not that this is the content we're teaching, you have to stick to that. I think this is one of the criticisms I have in my current research of what we're actually teaching. We're sticking to, like, kind of a set of regulations that's been enforced by an outside regulator. I shouldn't use the word enforced, but, you know, we're complying with an outside regulator. And in some ways that has a tendency to go with a tick box kind of, you know, I taught that proficiency, I taught that competence. And it comes into kind of, you know, that banking style of education that Paulo Ferreira talks about and is critical of. And this is a little bit about the hidden curriculum. You know, what is the hidden curriculum about? And Marion Bogo, a social work academic in Canada, is very good on this and very strong that, you know, engagement with your student is not just about the lecture and the content. It's how you greet in the corridor, the email they send you, that debrief time, how you give feedback, the types of assessments you do. And I think if you're going to think about yourself in terms of activism and bridging that gap between theory to practice. As academics, I think we have a responsibility to know what's going on in the world, first of all, but also to bring to life that into the curriculum, and to make the pedagogy kind of relevant and real in terms of actually the lives of the students. I'll give you an example. Like, I was teaching this year and we were talking about drugs. Not, you know, how to use them or anything, but, you know, just about the nature of drugs in the sphere of kind of Misuse of Drugs Act and,
okay, right.
and criminality. And it was a content related piece. And one of the students made a statement that, oh, did you see recently that if you get convicted of a drugs charge, you go to prison for life? And that kind of stopped me in my track. And I was going, OK, that's a really interesting statement. But where are you getting the evidence? Where did you hear this, and how you come across that information? And the answer was TikTok. You know, this is on TikTok. And I actually had seen the piece on TikTok. It was Senator Lynn Ryan talking about convictions and the convictions bill, that, you know, if you're convicted of a criminal offence, that stays on your criminal record for life. But the student in the 5 second, 10 second clip they saw interpreted that as, you know, you're going to prison for life if you have a drug conviction. So, you know, and we had a really interesting conversation about where do you get your information for informing yourself about political and social issues? And that opened up the whole conversation about social media, algorithms, confirmation bias, echo chambers, emotional content as opposed to evidence content. And I think we have a responsibility to look at and critically look at how students are getting information. There's a very interesting piece by Mike Caulfield called The SIFT Method, and he talks about how you actively look at the sources you're doing. And I do this in the classes from day one. You know, when I'm asking them to research for an assignment, you know, I get them to see what sources are you using and how can you validate or credit it by using this SIFT method that he talks about. And I think we need to build that and make assessment meaningful and real as well for students, like getting them as an active part of their assessment and getting them to really think about themselves, not just as students, but in the context of where they come from, the families they come from, the political opinions in families that inform them, you know, how they actually come with their baggage into the lecture room and, you know, how they can be reflective of that. So there's loads of things there, but I think to ignore that as an academic, we're not fully taking responsibility for an individual's learning.
Yeah, no, just to build exactly on what John said there, you know, about the baggage that students bring into classrooms, I think we need to really, really be so aware that students, you know, are experts in their own lived experience. And, you know, it's really, really important if I'm ever delivering like a class on like housing, you know, I have to be so conscious we're in the middle of a housing crisis, you know, and, you know, someone could very easily, a lot of people could be easily impacted in a class of 70. You know what I mean? It would be shocking if someone wasn't. But those are the kind of experiences, whether it's mental health, it's addiction, you know, it's being through the system in whatever way, shape or form, housing, you know, whatever it is, people are, their lived experience and their attitudes and opinions are shaped by everything they've been through. And, you know, we need to be cognizant of that, that we're not like, you know, as you mentioned, kind of like shutting down the debate, slamming things down, but saying, like John said, you know, where did you get that? Why do you think that? And try and kind of tease that out. But as well, as I would always kind of encourage students, we'd go through the SIFT method as well. What we try and do is turn students into problem posers. So, you know, that Freirean method of the lecturer or the educator as problem poser, it's also getting students to do that to me. So I try and flip the classroom. So I said, look, I want a bunch of toddlers. That's what I want. I want about 40 toddlers looking up at me and I say something and I want you to say, but why? And I say something again, but why? Yeah. And just keep saying it. And I'm trying to do that to kind of invoke a Socratic method where people get used to kind of pushing their arguments, but then backing them up with evidence until the person, the toddler finally kind of gets the answer that they want and is like, right, okay. Or they get bored and walk off. Either way is a way that works. So to try and get people to really think critically, but also critically interrogate where those opinions are coming from. Is it their own bias? Is it something that they've been raised with? Is it something they've been conditioned? Is there a hidden curriculum? And I think students really, really take a lot from that. But also we need to realise we bring a lot of bias. We bring a hell of a lot of bias into the classroom too. And we need to be really aware about how we interact in that too.
I could talk to the two of you all day, but I am conscious of time, and we was going to discuss a piece that you've written, the Responding to Ross Gray, Addressing the Immigration Debate in Ireland, a Thorough Analysis. But you that's a thorough analysis, but you've kind of hit on a number of the themes that are brought up in that. But I will include that as a link in the show notes, and you've also referenced some other materials throughout the conversation. If you might send those on to me so that I can include those on the show notes as well. So if anyone is listening who would like to follow up on some of this, some of these topics, that would be really helpful. But I do want to ask you one other question before you leave. And I think this debate is very healthy, very timely, very necessary. And I suspect we're going to be having it again and again and again and again. But I do want to ask you another question that's kind of a little bit of a reset, but in a different way. And it's somebody I've asked pretty much everyone, I think, who's been on this podcast. Somebody is new to research, novice researcher, new to research. They could be straight out of an undergrad. They might be an undergrad student. Maybe they're a middle-aged person coming back into it. Who knows? Somebody's coming into research. Have you got a bit of advice for them? Any bit of advice?
I might just take one part of that first. And I suppose the piece of advice from kind of looking back at my former self, and I was to look back at myself as embarking in research as a student, that I always had this kind of preconceived notion that there was a set way of doing things, that it had to be a formula I followed. And yes, there are academic rigor and there's an academic integrity that's involved, and there's certain kind of standards you have to reach in academic terms. But what I would say that there's, you know, there is no one way just to do research. You know, I think this has been very much kind of out there that you have to do kind of these massive big studies, quantitative types of studies. And this is nothing against quantitative or scientific studies. Absolutely valid. But it's more the, you know, there are other ways of doing research as well that is just as important. And, you know, that whole quantitative qualitative debate has been pitched against each other. I'm a qualitative researcher, so I tend to look at kind of things in depth and look for the story. And, you know, some of the quantitative researchers out there are probably just now fingernails on a blackboard when they hear that. But at the same time, that type of study and that type of research is just as valid and just as critically important. And it's not pitching one against the other. Both can be complementary and both have something to offer, but in different ways. And coming into research, I think it's important to know that there are loads of different ways to do research. Yeah. And I think to find your groove, you know, that kind of Homer Simpson piece of finding his groove on the couch, is sitting back, look and try and find your groove and find, you know, what you really enjoy. Whether, like, we just had a workshop and podcast as a way of researching, academic researching. Fascinating. Absolutely mind-blowing that you can research that way. And I think one of the biggest points the presenter, Stacey Copeland, was making, you know, this can be fun. You know, research can be fun. You don't have to be stuck in a desk kind of in a dark room and sitting kind of looking at reams and reams of papers. Yes, there's parts of that you have to do, but you can embark and engage in that in so many different ways. And a lot of the dissertation students I supervise, like it's a transformative moment or a threshold moment where you see them when they've gone out and interviewed their participants. And they come back and that's the piece they enjoy the most.
Yeah.
You know, that's the piece they really get something from and go, wow, I can see why I've been doing this all along. It clicks into place. So I think just, you know, don't be kind of discouraged. I remember starting my PhD journey and, you know, I had some criticism from, you know, from people around me saying that's not a real way of doing research.
Who said that?
Oh, well,
oh no! You
well.
Don't have to name them, but
you know, and
they weren't experts with
but they were coming from a very specific, defined way of doing research themselves that hadn't really gone outside their scope.
Yeah,
and you know, those kind of things, those kind of academic snobbery that can take place, can put people back years, and sometimes also completely discourage people from doing academic research at all. So I said, you know, to hell with the begrudgers around it. You find your way of doing it. What you have to contribute and what you have to say is just as valid. Find your way of saying it.
Steph, same question to yourself.
Yeah, like first things first, chill. Like get out of your head. And it's very easy for me to say that, but it's taken me years to get out of my head.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm saying that, because academia is sick. It has a disease, and that disease is profit. And I really mean that, because, you know, not only is there a certain type, like a type A perfectionism to what kind of journal, what kind of metric, what kind of ranking that you need to get into. No, it's even worse than that. It's like, you know, you're straight out of your PhD or your mid PhD. Why haven't you published in that A ranking journal? Otherwise, it's not worthwhile. And that really, really pisses me the hell off. Okay, because when we talk about worthwhile research, peer review as this kind of, you know, this really, you know, like this holy grail of what we should be achieving, doesn't actually matter if it's paywalled and it's €54 to access for a day and it's impossible to get. Mm-hmm. What is the point if it's going to be siphoned away from anyone to be able to access it? So on one hand, we actually really need to sit back and reflect about what is worthwhile research. And some of the best articles and some of those hard-hitting pieces I've ever read weren't in top-hitting, you know, peer-reviewed journals. Or maybe they were sample pieces pre-conference, and then maybe later on down the line they were turned into journal pieces with a lot of refining and a lot of editing. So what I'd say now is just enjoy the research, enjoy your journey, and 100% don't let it get in on you, because imposter syndrome is a real thing, especially if you're a woman. Oh my God. And if you're working class, like, you know, or like, it's just, it's a very, very narrow game still. So, or if you have a disability, oh my God, they're like, and I'm speaking my own personal experience as a working class woman with a disability. It's like, this is not a space for you. You have to claw your way to get here. And, you know, feckin' hell, you're there. You're good enough. You're strong enough. If you want practical suggestions, my own practical suggestions, I would say go to conferences. That's a big one. Try and submit conference papers for panels, for discussions, for presentations. OK, they're not as time consuming. They're a great way to network, and they're a great way to get your voice out there and get you used to refining at question and answer time. Someone might criticize or give you constructive criticism. That's exactly what you want. But it'll also help build your confidence. It don't set your sights on the top, you know, association, top journal, top conference, submit it, get it rejected, and then just feel, you know, absolutely crippled with, you know, low self-esteem. Start, you know, first of all, start where you feel comfortable. Find your groove and move up from there. But also, really importantly, like I said, it doesn't have to be even in a journal. It could be like writing a piece, a really important piece like Ross Gray. Do you know what I mean? It could be on a blog post. It could be on a friend. It could be, you know, just a smaller kind of research hub or association on your college website, your graduate website. But just start getting into the habit of it. Build up your confidence that way. And that just opens so many doors for you. So I would say, like, see, and podcasting, obviously, as well, like, duh.
Obviously, yes.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. So, like, you know, start where you're at, and whatever you do, don't let it make you feel like you're any less worthwhile of an academic or the person who's sitting beside you in that classroom who's spouting on about how they got into this journal and they're the bee's knees, okay? It happens to everyone. We've all been there.
Steph Hanlon and John Balfe, you've been wonderful guests. I genuinely could talk to you all day, but I think I'd love to pick this conversation up again, maybe get a few more people involved, and we might get a bit of a ding dong going as well. We could have a few sparklers and fireworks, perhaps. I'll get those links off you, and we'll include those as they'll be in the show notes. So if anyone wants to follow up on some of this material, I'll also have contact information for yourselves. So if they want to follow up with some of the stuff that you're discussing, thank you so much for sitting down here to me today. It's genuinely been a pleasure.
Great.
Yay,
Rob.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 9 Plus. For more information on this podcast and others, check out the SETU website at setu.ie.